My heart has no words. My eyes have no tears left. Mind had done gone crazy. Went off and married my fears. Now I'm standing here with nothing left to tell you. I'm standing here with nothing to prove. I got nothing to prove.
Welcome to Mormon Expression Voices. This is Heather, and today I'm going to be interviewing Sonia, a listener of Mormon Expression from the East Coast, who is also a friend of Richard of Norway, who does all of our website and technical stuff for the podcasts. And I think he might have been on a few episodes as well. But anyway, hello, Sonia.
Hi. Hi, Heather.
Why don't we just go ahead and do what I always do on Mormon Expression Voices and just jump right into your story.
Okay.
You grew up as a member in New Jersey, right?
Yes, New Jersey.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
I'm a Jersey girl.
So tell me about your experiences growing up in the church.
Grew up in New Jersey. My parents are both from Utah. And my dad got a job in New York City at some point, and I was around two. So we moved to New Jersey, and I lived there all through high school. There was a few families from my ward in my high school, so we were definitely a minority as far as growing up in the church. And I went to early morning seminary, which was like a couple towns away, so we had to get up at 5 a.m. and drive over there. But I loved it. I could see all my friends.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I was one of just a few people in my high school that was Mormon, and most people knew that I was Mormon. They didn't necessarily know what that meant. You know, some people knew that I went to seminary and they just called it Bible class. They thought that was weird, but sort of cool. And they definitely knew that I didn't drink. And so they, you know, kind of made lots of comments about that. Sometimes boys knew the other parts about being Mormon. So I wasn't necessarily someone that dated very much in high school because, you know, they would kind of hear what it meant to date a Mormon girl, and they were not really interested in, in those things. So, but I really had, you know, I loved growing up in New Jersey, and I really loved being a Mormon. Even though I knew I didn't necessarily fit in, I didn't have a problem with that. In some ways, I suppose I liked being different.
Mm-hmm.
I had friends that kind of accepted me for who I was, and it wasn't really a problem growing up.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you said that you traveled a long distance for seminary?
Yeah, yeah. Our ward was maybe 15 minutes away by car.
Mm-hmm.
I sometimes still wonder if I caught up on all that sleep I lost in those years of high school.
So you were okay with it because you got to see your friends. Did you put special significance on your LDS friends?
Not necessarily. I just, it's just something I've thought about recently. Like, why would I do that? Why would I get up at 5 a.m. and go to church basically 5 days a week? And I just have been thinking about it. I think that really was probably more of the draw for me than anything else, because my sister and I talk about this a little bit. She didn't really have any other girls her age.
Mm-hmm.
And so she had a totally different experience than I did. She didn't enjoy going to seminary. She didn't really enjoy going to church, but I had a few friends. And so I just think it just led for it was a totally different experience for me than it was for her, probably.
So how about your feelings towards the church as a kid and an adolescent? Did you enjoy being a Mormon? Did you have any specific thoughts about Mormonism? Was it just kind of something that you were and something you did because that's what was in your life?
I definitely liked being Mormon. There was something that I identified with early on.
Mm-hmm.
You know how you hear growing up, you know, you shouldn't depend on your parents' testimony.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I always thought that was such a strange thing because I always felt like I have a really strong testimony, and I wasn't always sure even that my parents did have a testimony. So in some ways I felt like I probably had a stronger testimony than they did.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, no, I really liked it. I loved going to girls' camp. I had some good friends. In fact, I was with one of them yesterday that I we were in the same state growing up. And so that was like the chance I got to see them was at stake dances and at mm-hmm. girls camp and all that kind of thing. I remember kind of at a young age sort of realizing that I was in a minority, you know. Mm-hmm. I knew that definitely, but it didn't, like I said, it didn't really bother me. I didn't mind feeling kind of different. You know, another thing I've been thinking about recently is that I really always had a fascination with people who were converts. And I just thought it was, on the one hand, I felt like I had a really strong testimony of the church. But on the other hand, I felt like when I would hear people talk about being converted to the church, I felt kind of jealous of them because I felt like, oh, they've had some major experience that has brought them into the church. Mm-hmm. And I always felt like that was something I almost wished had happened to me.
So you thought part of the conversion was some really profound spiritual experience that you had missed since you'd grown up in it?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. Obviously, I had issues as far as doctrinal things that bothered me. You know, not until I was more a teenager, but polygamy always really bothered me. Mm-hmm. I felt, you know, I've been surprised since I've sort of like found this community that people are saying that they didn't know that Joseph Smith, you know, that he had plural wives. Mm-hmm. Because that was something that I always knew and it always bothered me. But I also believe that story of he didn't really want to do it. he didn't want to be that person. Mm-hmm. He was like compelled because this was the plan.
Okay.
I really bought into that story.
Can I ask you how you found out about Joseph Smith's polygamy?
I definitely remember learning about it in seminary.
Oh.
I must have also learned about it in Sunday school because I remember pretty clearly I have one pretty close friend that was my same age that she and I both really had an issue with it. Mm-hmm. And we would talk about it. It must have come up a lot because I remember always asking, you know, we were taught that story of how people practice polygamy because they had to take care of the widows and mm-hmm. The widows. And mm-hmm. so I would just say, but you know, you can kind of take care of a person without marrying the person and having kids right. with the person. And so I remember having those discussions in Sunday school.
Okay. For some reason, I was expecting you to say that, you know, a kid in your school told you, maybe somebody knew something about it and teased you and that's how you found out. But it was actually through seminary and the church. That's interesting.
Yeah, but actually now that you say that, it did happen sometimes.
Okay.
That people would ask me about it in school. They would say, how many moms do you have?
Oh.
Like, it didn't make any sense to me, obviously, because only one person can give birth to a child, you know? Yeah, that did happen, actually, now that you say that. And I do remember probably in high school having one or two people saying, well, yeah, I know you don't do polygamy now, but in Utah, they still do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, obviously, I would say that's not true. Whether or not they believed me, I don't know.
Okay.
That was, you know, one of the things that sort of bothered me. But, I, you know, I could kind of say, well, it's not something that we do now. So
I don't have to worry about it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
What were the other things that bothered you? Do you remember?
I don't know if I would say this bothered me, but I always was confused by the fact that it seemed like we got lots of revelation through Joseph Smith, but nothing since then, like no more, you know, new information about, you know, whatever, the plan of salvation or whatever. Mm-hmm. So I always thought that was odd, but I wouldn't say that bothered me. And then at conferences when the prophet would just kind of talk about just everyday things, I always thought it was kind of odd. But growing up in New Jersey, we had to drive pretty far, actually, to even watch General Conference. I didn't really even kind of know that much about, because my dad didn't want to go. It wasn't until I was at BYU when my roommate turned on the radio Saturday morning and started blaring Conference and started cleaning the apartment. And I was like, oh, you can just listen to it at home. It was a totally foreign thing to me.
Right. So should we talk about you going to college?
My senior year, my family moved to Tennessee. Uh-huh. And this is where I felt like I really did gain a testimony. I mean, it's hard to say that now, but I had a really strong spiritual experience there that sometimes I still kind of try to make sense of, you know, now that I kind of taking a step back from the church. When we first moved to Tennessee, in our stake, I guess, was doing this like a program, not a road show, but that type of a thing. Mm-hmm. And all the young women were singing songs with the values. Do they still do the values in young women?
I think so, yeah.
One of the songs was about divine worth. Is that
divine, individual worth and divine
individual
nature.
Worth? Yes, that's the one. And so she was singing this song about individual worth, and like the words are, "I am of worth of Is that right? So anyway, okay. The words to the song just struck me because I had been. I grew up in New Jersey my whole life. I moved to this place that was so foreign to me, where. People refer to me as a Yankee. They're very racist down there, which I was not used to. It was like a very different experience. And going down there at the age of 17, it was harder to make friends. And so I felt like really alone. And when I heard the words to this song, it just really struck me as somebody somewhere loves me. Heavenly Father loves me. Jesus loves me. It was such a strong feeling that I actually ran out of the room and was crying in the bathroom. And my young women's leader came in and talked to me. I've told this story a lot of times. I didn't really expect to be emotional about it, but you know, it was at that moment that I really did feel like there is something bigger than me, and there's somebody who's kind of watching out for me and who loves me and who knows me. That was when I decided I wanted to go on a mission, you know, kind of going back to what I, you know, was talking about earlier about feeling so fascinated by people's conversion stories and feeling, you know, people who join the church. I just felt like that experience was so major for me that I was going to go and share it with other people, you know, as a missionary. So at 17, I decided I was going to go on a mission, which I did.
But not for a few years.
Right.
So were you in Tennessee until you went to college?
Yes. And that was one of the reasons that I really decided to go to BYU. Growing up, I never wanted to go to BYU. I know this is really naive to say, and I completely admit it, but to me, I felt like it was a cop-out to go there, or it was like a safety school. Uh-huh. I know it's hard, you know, some people will not like hearing that because they, you know, I know it's not easy to get into, but that was just the way I thought about it. Mm-hmm. And so after moving to a new place and having no friends for such a long time, I felt like I wanted to go to BYU because I already knew people who would be there and I wouldn't feel like I was starting over. And my best friend was going and we ended up roommates. So it was the only school I applied to, which is also really naive.
So how was BYU? Did you enjoy being in that Mormon soaked culture?
It was definitely different, obviously, but I really did love it at first. I, you know, as I said earlier, being one of very few Mormons in my high school, I really loved the idea of just walking down campus and everybody was like me. And, you know, I kind of just pictured myself dating a ton because I didn't date in high school at all. I thought, you know, this was like my chance to have all those experiences, but it didn't totally turn out that way. And when I got there, I really did love it, really loved being in college. But it wasn't exactly like that, but I did date a little bit.
Okay.
Right. And, you know, living with my best friend was great because, like I said, we grew up in the same, we both grew up in New Jersey, but we didn't live near each other. So we didn't get to see each other very often. So, you know, it was really fun living with her and I had other friends and I did like it at first.
Did it change at some point where you didn't enjoy it after a while?
Probably more after my mission.
Okay.
That I felt like I wasn't, maybe I didn't fit in as much as I had wanted to.
Okay. So tell me about almost getting kicked out of BYU.
Yes. So this happened in the first like 2 weeks of going to BYU.
Oh.
Yeah. So it was, I think classes start just a week or two before Labor Day. So Labor Day weekend, I had gone with some friends. We had some, I met some people that lived off campus in a house. And so two of my roommates and I went over to these guys' house. They were all returned missionaries. There was like, they were so like glamorous and older than us. And so we went over to watch videos at their house and then slept over. And I slept on the floor in the living room, and some of the other people kind of paired off, but I didn't. Like a couple months later, was it? It might have been a couple weeks later. My roommates told on us. So we got called in to standards. I was so completely oblivious to the fact that I had broken any rules because I was off campus. Like, it did not occur to me for 1 second that they could tell me what I could do when I was off campus. They said, well, you slept at these boys' house. I said, yeah, but I was just sleeping, you know, I was by myself and nothing happened. And honestly, to this point, I was 18 years old. I had never even kissed a boy. So the fact that I almost got kicked out of BYU when I was so innocent, I mean, just, I look back at it and I just think it's crazy. I went to standards, and this guy was, you know, asking me questions and stuff. And it really bothered me that he didn't know me. Like, he didn't know anything about me. And he's the one who's making a decision about whether I stay or go. You know, and, you know, as an adult now, and I work with teenagers who do tend to lie, I can totally get that he would not believe me, that he would go, this girl's, you know, full of it. I got in trouble, I think. And then my roommate, who was one of the ones that paired off with one of the guys, she must have corroborated my story because she was put on probation, but I was not. And then a couple months later, I don't remember exactly what happened. I think we had a friend over, and if I'm remembering the situation right, it was one of my friends who, he was taking a class with one of my other roommates and didn't buy the textbook. So he came over to read her textbook. And when he left, the RAs saw him leaving. So I got called in to standards again. And again, it was a totally innocent situation. The only reason I didn't get kicked out was because in the first place, I hadn't been put on probation. If I had been on probation, I would have been sent home. And he said to me, well, you know, since you are already on probation, I see no reason for you to stay here. And I said, no, no, I wasn't, I'm not on probation. And he said, you're not? And he checked my records and he said, well, you should have been, but okay, now you are. So they sent a letter home to my parents, and my dad called me and was, he didn't get really angry or yell at me. He just was like, you know, what are you doing?
Right. You know?
So it was just so ironic to me that I was just such a good girl and, you know, such an innocent, crazy situation. I think you said this in your interview. It's like they were so much more strict than my own parents. It was the weirdest situation to be in.
Well, and as I'm listening to you, I feel like it's a creepy environment. This has been my experience with the church, that your bishop doesn't come to you and say, I saw you in the liquor store on Saturday, you know, or somebody reported to me that you were in the liquor store on Saturday. So let's start the repentance process. The repentance process starts with the individual going and confessing something. Whereas it seems like at these church schools, nothing at all it could be that there's nothing going on, but there's somebody that's prying into your activities and making judgments about them and deciding what the fate should be for those actions. It just seems to be the antithesis of what the church claims, how it claims to work.
Yeah, that's right. And I even had professors at BYU who would say things like, Joseph Smith taught, I know I'm going to get this wrong, teach correct principles and then let them govern themselves. That's attributed to Joseph Smith.
I believe so.
I just remember one in particular saying this, like, this place has too much control, you know, exerts too much control. But yeah. I do know that I had a friend that went to, it was Rick's at that time, who went to Rick's, and we went to visit her, and it felt 10 times worse up there. Yeah. And I was only there for a weekend, you know.
Well, I've heard, I didn't go to a church school, but I've heard that that's the case because Rexburg is a small insular community. And so there's a lot more oversight over the people who live there than there is at BYU. Provo's much larger and mm-hmm. you can get away from campus, basically.
Yeah. So I almost got kicked out of BYU for really nothing. That first year was kind of an odd situation, but. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you went to BYU for a couple of years before going on a mission?
Yes. I went for 3 years.
3 years. Okay.
And I was so desperate to go on a mission that I just counted down the days. You know, when you're a freshman, you make all these new friends, and then after your freshman year, they all leave and go on missions. And I was just so jealous of all of them. You know, at one point, there was this rumor going around that they were making a change in the system. Mm-hmm. And I was convinced they were changing the age for women to go on missions.
So you could go at 19?
Yeah, or 20. Oh, okay. I was so happy. And then it turned out to be they changed that process where you paid a flat fee rather than paying according to, you know, where you go.
Huh. Okay.
Yeah. So I was very excited. And people would say, you know, at BYU, like when I would tell people I wanted to go on a mission, they would say, well, no, you won't. You'll get married. You know, I would just say, no, I'm not. I'm not interested in getting married. I don't want to be a teen bride, mm-hmm. you know. But I did actually meet somebody when I was 19. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say I really considered not going, but that was like my first real experience, like being serious with somebody and even considering getting married. And I felt like, you know, this is what I decided to do, is go on a mission, and this is what I'm going to do. And I finished my 3 years, and then I packed up my car and drove back to Jersey and put in my papers.
So did this relationship with this guy not work out because of your mission?
Well, in a way it did. He, like I said, most of his friends were already married. So it's so hard looking back. I don't know how serious he really was. And it mm-hmm. was easy for him to maybe say he wanted to get married knowing that I was so disinterested in getting uh-huh. married, uh-huh. but met him kind of close to the end of the school year. We had one of those relationships where, you know, very typical BYU. Like we met by the end of the week, we were saying, I love you.
Yeah.
Went home with him to Arizona. But I think the whole thing lasted 2 months. So it's like really crazy.
You know? Well, very Mormon. The reason I was asking is that I was wondering if when you put in your papers to go on a mission, if you had ecclesiastical leadership telling you that you needed to be considering getting married instead or anything like that.
Oh, that's such a good question. Actually, we had broken up. So that was my sophomore year. And I was one of those girls that, and I say girl on purpose because what I was doing was very immature. Just mm-hmm. every day saying like, what are we doing this summer? Are you, you know, are mm-hmm. we going to see other people? Are we going to do this? And he was like, yes, of course we're going to see other people because you're going on a mission. So when I came home that summer, it just fizzled. He wasn't putting the effort into it that I wanted him to. Mm-hmm. So it ended up, we broke up. And then I just was so heartbroken mm-hmm. that, I mean, for a 2 month relationship, it took me a really long time to get over him. Mm-hmm. But he comes back to the story. So stay tuned. So anyway, by the time I was old enough to go on a mission, he was not in the picture anymore. So nobody ever gave me any kind of pressure about that. And I really felt like in my ward in New Jersey that the women in my ward were so jealous. They were just like, oh, that's so exciting that you're going on a mission. And because I think so many of them had gotten married so young that they saw this as some fantastic adventure. Mm-hmm. So definitely did not have any pressure from anyone at home. So
okay. So where did you go on your mission?
I went to Norway, which is how I know Richard. Mm-hmm. Very excited, although I did not know anything about Norway. You know, a lot of people that go to Norway have family from there, you know, kind of going back, their ancestors are from there, but I didn't. And I was super excited and I worked 3 jobs and saved all my money and paid for the whole thing. And I was totally on board with the whole thing. And then I went to the MTC and I just found that to be such a strange experience because I had lived it in Provo. So just like living up the street from my sister and my friends was really weird, but it was okay.
Did you find the MTC culture oppressive?
Did you say oppressive?
Oppressive, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't feel it was oppressive. I mean, I heard people say like, you're going to feel the spirit every day. That was definitely not true. I had a companion that was very difficult to get along with, so much so that anytime I was alone with anyone else in my group, they would just turn to me and say, I don't know how you do it. So I was really excited to get out of there. It was tough, you know.
We jumped right to going to the MTC, but before you went to the MTC, you obviously went through the temple for the first time. So how was that?
So I actually liked the temple the first time that I went. So I went to BYU in 1988. So all of the young men that I knew all went through the temple before the changes. And so they would go home for the weekend and come back like seriously white as a ghost. You know, just having going, oh my gosh, what did I get myself into? Kind of a thing. So I was really expecting something pretty strange. But I went through one of those temple classes or temple prep classes. And I felt actually pretty prepared for it. I mean, it was definitely unusual. You know, it felt different, but I didn't feel really freaked out necessarily. And the one thing I really liked was the washing and anointings, because all of that was women. What's the word?
Women acting out the priesthood.
Yeah, exactly. They were the ones performing all of these rituals with us. So to me, that was actually really nice. But then once you're in the actual endowment and you have to like put the veil on, and there's something about obeying your husband that did bother me a lot, actually. But it wasn't new to me, you know, to this idea of being subservient to men. I think I kind of explained it away like, well, we all know how it actually works, you know, in the families. But, you know, I living in New Jersey, our closest temple was 4 hours away. So I only went that one time. Oh, actually, something that's sort of interesting about it is, so my parents were not married in the temple. My dad was like a Southern Utah bad boy. And so they didn't go through the temple until my brother and my sister and I were all born. From what I understand, my dad never went through again
until I
went on my mission. So that's...
Do you know why he didn't?
He smoked and drank coffee. And I feel okay saying this because he's really open about it. That when my parents got married, he was kind of on the fringes. He was one of those, you know, a Jack Mormon. And so I think he got it together for a little while. And then it's, you know, it's hard. So I remember asking him just a couple years ago, so when did you quit smoking? And he said, I don't know. And I said, how do you not know? And he said, you know, I quit so many times, I don't even know which one took. So I'm not exactly sure about this, but that would have happened in like 1972, maybe, that they went through the temple and we were all sealed. And then if he went through the next time, it would have been either with me or he had another friend who was a convert who he went through with also. So that like in the early 90s was the next time he went to the temple. So that was like sort of an interesting thing because I felt like he... You know, as I said, we didn't go to general conference and things growing up just because he wasn't really that interested in it. But after that, he got very interested in the church and now actually is a temple worker.
Okay. So, tell me about going to Norway and what your experience was like as a missionary there.
Within the first month of being there, And I remember it was the first month because I was only with my trainer for 1 month. I just turned to her and said, what are we doing here? Like, what if this is not true? This is torture. And she said, you know, I've thought about that too. And I just really think we're helping people. So even if this is not true, we're doing a good thing and nobody's going to blame us for doing something wrong.
What had made you start contemplating whether or not the church was true?
Well, you know, you hear all these stories growing up about how great the mission is and it's the two best years and all that kind of thing. And it was so hard, you know, and boring. You know, you you're supposed to work like 70, 80 hours a week and nobody wants to talk to you ever at all, you know? And actually my MTC teacher told me this, I remember. She said, just think, you know, they're not rejecting you. They're rejecting the gospel. And I remember feeling really like within the first couple of weeks, like that does not help. This really feels like a rejection of me. So it was just, you know, day after day, just feeling like it's a waste of your time. It's not, people aren't interested. And I know part of that is being in Europe and especially in Scandinavia, where
it's very secular.
You know, yeah, it's very secular. You know, they're mostly atheists. They're very apathetic about it. Pretty early on, I went, wow, this is not what I was expecting. This is not what I was told it was going to be.
So,
and there was also like this idea of, like, I felt like, you know, everyone said, oh, you know, Scandinavian missions, these are like the hardest in the world. I have no idea, you know, why people said that, if that's really true or whatever. But I just had this idea like, well, this must mean that we are the strongest ones. Mm-hmm. And then I just felt really not strong. You know, I just felt like this really is getting to me a lot.
I would imagine there was very little success in getting investigators in a secular country like Norway. Did you start spending your time in other ways, volunteering to help out with stuff, or were you required to do the same thing day after day after day?
Yeah, well, it's funny you say that because we did find ways of spending our time, and that was just hanging out with each other, mostly, the missionaries. And, you know, still some of the missionaries that I served with, some of my companions are really some of my closest friends today. It's been almost 20 years. So that was a huge thing, just having each other, really. And we did look for service opportunities. Like if we could find some service opportunity, we were just in heaven. But it's hard because it's a socialist country. A lot of that stuff is taken care of. And they don't really, you know, want us to...
A lot of soup kitchens and stuff like that.
Yeah, and they didn't trust us. They didn't trust that we just wanted to come help them do stuff. They felt like there would be an ulterior motive to us helping. But I remember in two different areas, in one area in Oslo, we would go to... there was a nursing home. And so we would go do gardening for them. And in another city I served in, Trondheim, we would help at a home where people who are terminally ill go, and they live there and go to the hospital every day because it's close to the hospital. So we'd go and like clean the floors and do stuff like that. Those kinds of things we lived for because, yeah, it was just really tough to get out there. And I remember I had this one investigator. She was a young mom. She had just maybe a 6-month-old baby. She and her husband started fighting a lot because he felt like she was changing, you know, after talking to us. And so I felt really bad about that. I was like, well, I certainly don't want to be causing like a rift in somebody's marriage. I talked to my mission president about it. And he said, you know what? We're here to bring families together, not tear them apart. And I felt so like relieved when he said that I just felt like this is fine. You know, I feel fine cutting her loose. And, you know, she started avoiding us and things like that. So it wasn't like, you know, I made the decision never to go back. I felt, good about that. We taught a lot of people from other countries.
Immigrants.
immigrants. Yeah. So it felt like it was almost like, you know, we're not trying to help up. We're not trying to build up Norway here. We're teaching these people from Africa who are going to go back to Africa and build it up over there. Hmm. It was just a really, it wasn't what I expected at all. As far as like teaching, you know, often we would have investigators that would be kind of your investigators for like 6 months or a year or something. You know, sometimes they'd be around for even longer. I met this one person who was about halfway through my mission. Mm-hmm. And the way that we met him was I met his mom when I was my very first area. So we met her, and then she and I both moved to another city around the same time, but we didn't really know it. Mm-hmm. So we just happened to run into each other one time in the train station. Mm-hmm. And so she gave me her address and we went to visit her. Her son was there. He had just gotten out of the army and he was living in her basement or something. And she was one of those people that was kind of interested in just kind of talking about religion, but he was even more so. And he mm-hmm. ended up joining the church. We would all kind of hang out as missionaries a lot, and, you know, especially like on P days and things mm-hmm. like that. And so he kind of was one of the group. And his story was just like so amazing to me. He was somebody who just heard it. It made sense to him and joined the church within 3 weeks, which is, that's like the goal of what you're trying to get people to do, you know? Mm-hmm. So one night, I can't remember what we were doing, but he was there and he slipped me this note and it said, "Thank you so much for introducing me to the gospel and inspiring me to get down on my knees and pray. And if it hadn't been for you, I would never have, you know, made this choice. And you gave me the courage to do all of this." It was like, you know, all of a sudden I had this, after all these months of feeling like, what are we doing here? Where, you know, why are we doing this? You know, I felt like this was my purpose of going to Norway, mm-hmm. was to meet this person.
So even if he was the only baptism in your mission, that was why God had sent you out.
Absolutely. Yep.
Okay.
And I will tell you, Heather, to this day, I have not seen Saturday's Warrior. Mm-hmm. But I know there's like this plot about people who know each other mm-hmm. in the pre-existence. Mm-hmm. And I completely convinced myself that I had known him in the pre-existence and that I had gone to Norway to meet him and that we were supposed to know each other. Something happened one day. Somebody said something to him after church and he got very upset. The elders called me and said, "You have to talk to him. You have to help calm him down. He's talking about writing himself out of the church." And so I called him and, you know, I helped calm him down. And that kind of ended up happening like for the rest of my mission, that he would call me wherever I was.
Because he had learned something at church that upset him. And
yeah. So after I had moved away from this area, I don't know what happened specifically, but he either learned about polygamy or had always known about it and it mm-hmm. didn't bother him, but it started to bother him. I don't know exactly, but he was really upset about polygamy. He would call me and we would talk for hours on the phone, which was, I'm sure you know, completely against the rules. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if my whole purpose was going to Norway to meet this person, you know, it was my job to make sure that he stayed in the church. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I felt so conflicted because I had always been this good girl. But then on the other hand, I felt just this obligation to keep him in the church.
Well, and if you think about it, the missionary rules about not letting men and women be alone together is about sex. So if mm-hmm. you're just on the telephone with the guy, I guess you could have had phone sex, but I doubt that was.
Well, we definitely did not have that. But at some point, we did sort of confess having feelings for each other. And I was totally convinced that, you know, we were going to get married and, you know, live happily ever after. And it sort of like made me excited about, now I really was going to help build up the church in Norway because I was going to either maybe be there or something. I don't know.
Right.
So this ended up being a really big thing for me because I had so much guilt and shame about what I was doing. I knew I wasn't supposed to be talking to him at all, let alone talking about feelings or anything else. But
did you confess?
I did tell, you mean my confess to my mission president?
Yeah.
I don't remember if I told him or if this Norwegian man told him, but he knew. Like, I remember him saying, now, this is not the time, you know, you're supposed to finish your mission, but if you want to get married later, you can. And I was so shocked that he would say something like that to me, because I'm like, well, I don't really even know this person. But I told the Norwegian guy that, and he was so excited. He's like, yes, that's exactly what I want. You know, so it was, yeah. So I don't remember if I confessed, but he did know. And a couple months later, he called me, my mission president called. He knew that I had written this guy a letter or something. So he called me and he's like, I'm going to come down there and break your pencil. And
I was like, you're not allowed to even write letters?
No. You're not supposed to have any contact after you leave. Like, you're not supposed to have any contact with other missionaries that are outside your area. You're not supposed to talk to other, you know, members outside of your area or investigators that you knew. So that's actually a great question, because I always felt really strange about that, because there is something about, you know, you get close to people, you become part of their lives, and then you leave. And it was very often that once the missionary that taught that person left, the person, you know, the new member or whatever would feel abandoned. And they would feel like, you know, this person was so important to me and now they're gone. And not only are they gone, I'm not supposed to ever talk to them again. Like, I can't even call them. So it seems counterproductive in some ways. But on the other hand, with the experience that I had, I can see maybe why they do it. But, you know, there was just, I can't even tell you how many teenage girls or girls in their 20s never went back to church after the elder who they taught, who taught them left the area, you know. It was very common.
Of course. So did you keep in touch with this guy when you left Norway?
Yeah. So after I left the area where I knew him, I was in three other cities. And so the first city I was in, which was, I think, 3 or 4 months, we talked a lot. And then the next city I was in, we talked a little bit less. And then when I moved from there, I didn't even tell him I was moving. And so he felt abandoned. He felt like I had just rejected him. But I did, once I, you know, I just think back about how audacious I was. My mom came over to pick me up. And so I went to dinner with him and my mom.
Well, you were still a missionary.
Yeah. So like, I called him and I was like, hey, guess what? I'm in town. Let's go have dinner. So he met my mom in Norway, and he told me later that he was really mad at me because he thought that I would at dinner say, look, this is, you know, somebody who's important to me, and I would introduce him as
your boyfriend.
My boyfriend or something, yeah. But I did not do that. So it was, you know, it was a strange situation, and obviously in a lot of ways. And so when I went home, he was very confused. He was like, I don't really understand why you're going home. Why don't you just stay here and be with me? You're done with your mission. And he didn't understand that, you know, you have to go home and be released and all of that kind of thing, you know, report back to your stake president. I had just about another year left of school, so I went back to school, but I totally planned on...
You just had unfinished business, and once you got that done, you'd be back to Norway.
Absolutely, yeah. So when I got home, then we had made a plan that I would call him one time, and I called him and we talked for 2 hours, which cost a fortune. Mm-hmm. And he was just so focused on the fact that if he had left the church, that I wouldn't be with him. And he just kept saying, but that's not unconditional love. And I would say, but this is the only way it will work for me, mm-hmm. is if you're a member of the church. Mm-hmm. By then he had kind of stopped going. He, you know, started smoking again, things like that. Once I got back to BYU, I got a letter from him saying that he was moving on, and we didn't talk again until 2 years later. He had moved to the States, and he called me from California and said, I'm driving to New Jersey to be with you. So we did get a chance to kind of see if it was going to work out, but by that time, like, too many other things had happened, and I didn't really trust him.
Did you not trust him because he wasn't being religious?
Yeah, and I felt like he was hiding things from me. I felt like he really, you know, for example, he came with brand new scriptures. Mm-hmm. So I knew that he had gone and bought new scriptures, because before, you know, when I was in Norway, I saw his scriptures. You know, he had marked them up. He was in love with the Book of Mormon. He thought it was like the best thing ever. He was, you know, I was saying that first time we met him, we'd given him a Book of Mormon, and then we went back just a couple of days later, and he had already read half of it. So I knew that him coming to New Jersey with brand new scriptures meant that he was trying to prove something to me. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, he was totally right that I didn't accept him. I wouldn't have accepted him if he wasn't, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. being faithful. I was living with my parents, and he was living in our spare bedroom, and it was just not good. Mm-hmm. So he went back to California, and in my mind, it was not over, and we were going to still try and make it work. But it just kind of fizzled out, and I called him one time. I said, this is not working for me. You know, I said, it doesn't seem like you feel the same way about me anymore. And he was like, no, I do. Let's talk about it. And then we just never talked again. Hmm. That was my memory of it. Mm-hmm. But when I read through my journals like 2 years ago, mm-hmm. I saw this totally different picture of what happened, was that it was really all him feeling rejected by me because of the church.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So it was kind of at the beginning of me deciding I wasn't going to go to church anymore. So it was a Sunday. I just remember this. I pulled out all my old journals. I have a box of journals. And I spent the entire Sunday reading through every entry from that time. And I just laid in bed and sobbed and sobbed. You know, right. Just like all this time I was blaming him, and it was really my fault.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, well, that's kind of how things play out in the Mormon world, I think. You're supposed to be this person, and if you're not going to be this person, then it's not going to work.
Right, right. And so, have you read the Elna Baker book?
Yes.
So, you know that whole part of her atheist boyfriend?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when I read that book, I was on the train going to work, and I was just sobbing on the train because I just related to that so much of, mm-hmm. here is this woman who gave up this guy that she really loved because of her devotion to this church. Mm-hmm. And it was just so sad to me.
You related to it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I don't think I've ever done this, but I got to work and I sent her an email.
Yeah.
I said, I know you're telling my story, you know? I mean, it mm-hmm. was just the saddest thing, so.
So before we get to you having an Elna Baker-like existence in an NYC singles ward, let's talk about being at BYU after your mission. What year were you at BYU after your mission?
So I went back in 93.
And is that the year of the September 6th? I can't remember when that happened.
I believe it was 94.
Uh-huh.
And if it wasn't, then that was, even if it was earlier, I didn't know about it until my very last year, 94, 95. I graduated in 95.
Okay. But you were still...
And if you're
still...
doing the math, yes, it took me 5 years to get through.
But you were still at BYU in that time of the BYU feminism and all of that.
Yes. So I, it was my last year at BYU, and I don't know how I got connected, but I started going to the voice meetings. Mm-hmm. And, I remember there was lots of controversy around it because there was no faculty advisor. Like nobody wanted to touch this club. Mm-hmm. And, so some man, a male, professor from the law school said, you know, I don't want to see this club go away. So he took over. So I, you know, all of that stuff happened, I think, while I was away. Mm-hmm. And I heard about it, you know, where they put the signs up on campus, you know, that whole story where they put the signs up on campus saying any man seen after dark will be considered, you know, a danger to women, that kind of thing. Uh-huh. And so the club this voice club kind of got in trouble for that. And so when I was there, it was all the aftermath of that. Again, I don't even remember how I got involved, but it was like a new world was opened up to me. I loved it. I loved this whole idea. I took a women's studies class mm-hmm. and I loved it. So I said, I'm going to take this as a minor. And I couldn't believe it was something that you could study in college as women's studies. You know, embarrassingly, a year or two later, I found out, like, there's lots of universities all over this country that actually has it as a major.
Right.
You know, but I just thought it was fantastic. And so I took all these classes, you know, really enjoyed it. It was like a new world opening up to me. You know, I found people who thought like I did, you know, who had these same kind of issues with, you know, patriarchy. So I don't know. I didn't really know much about September 6th, but I did know about the BYU professor, was it Cecilia Farr?
I don't remember all of their names.
Yeah. So she got, you know, fired from BYU. Mm-hmm. And there were all of the, you know, all the students who really loved her were speaking out and trying to help her keep her job, and remember seeing it on the news and things like that. And so all of that was going on at this time. And it, even though I really didn't know a lot of it, it really scared me. Like, it just scared me that they had that much control over people to fire them. You know, I'm mm-hmm. sorry, to excommunicate people over differences in, you know, these opinions and things like that. I was kind of really self-absorbed in that I was trying to get over this failed relationship, which if you could call it that, you know, mm-hmm. I don't know. But, and at the same time, what am I going to do when I graduate? And all these kinds of things, these ideas, I had no idea what I was going to do, but the whole atmosphere was so scary to me. Mm-hmm. Because I really did love the church. And I feel like my blinders had come off a tiny bit on my mission. Mm-hmm. I still believed in it and felt like there was something threatening about it. And I also had one of my really good friends, another friend that I grew up with in New Jersey. She also went on a mission. We were on the missions at the same time. But as soon as she came out, came home, she came out of the closet and said, I'm done trying to live this life. So I got to know lots of her friends who were lesbians. And so I was just really immersed in this lesbian community at BYU too. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, you know, we would talk about it a lot and talk about that experience, but,
talk about the experience of coming out as a lesbian.
No, well, that, and just this idea of just feeling threatened, feeling like
you have to be careful about who you are and what you do.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
And that, you know, Boyd K. Packer made that statement of, you know, the enemies to the church are feminists and intellectuals and gay, you know, homosexuals. Mm-hmm. And I was really, really offended by that statement, you know, because I am a feminist and my very good friend is a lesbian. And I don't feel like either of us are an enemy of the church or a threat to the church, you know. Right. So that was just a hard, very hard time for me, like kind of starting to come to terms with all of that. Mm-hmm. And there was a part of Voice, we did this project, the Clothesline Project. I don't know if you've heard of that. Mm-hmm. Where people make t-shirts and hang them up and, you know, abuse victims and, you know, sexual abuse, physical abuse, domestic violence victims, they will make, or survivors, they make t-shirts and then we would hang them up in the, you know, on campus. And people would come through and just complain, like, this doesn't belong at BYU and this is not something that we should be talking about at BYU. And I was very confused about that because I thought, you know, these are BYU students who made these. So of course it makes sense to have these at BYU. So all of these experiences made me just say, I'm going to get out of Utah. I don't want to have anything to do with this anymore.
Right.
So when I graduated, I came back home and applied for graduate schools. And then I got my master's out here in New York City.
Okay. And I imagine that putting some distance between yourself and Provo, because that's kind of the heart of Mormonism around here, did that alleviate that fear you were having or the anxiety? Did it kind of go back to feeling like you were just a normal Mormon and all of that stuff wasn't a pressure anymore?
Yeah, it did actually. It was really, I felt like I was back home. I was with people that, that knew me and didn't put me in some, you know, put some label on me of being a threat to the church. You know, I was saying earlier, I liked being Mormon out here growing up because it made me different. And I felt like coming back here, I could be that person again. The person who was conservative in a liberal place rather than liberal in a conservative place, if that makes sense.
Yeah. No,
and I liked that position better.
Okay. When you went to school in New York, did you attend, I don't know, if it would it just be a straight singles ward with people who weren't in school, or was it kind of like a college ward?
No, it was a singles ward. At well, I lived at home while I was in school, and then once I graduated, I moved into the city.
Okay.
And by that time, I was 29 or 30, and there were three singles wards at that time, and two of them were 18. Is that right? No, there must have only been two. I'm sorry. There were three came later. One was 18 to 27. And one was 28 and over. And so there were some students, but not
many.
It was very different. There were a lot of people come to New York to be performers. Some work and some are in school. So So I was in the older singles ward, and you know, I had just after I'd come home from my mission again, I really didn't date at BYU, so I felt like this was my chance to come back home and date other people like me.
Right.
But what I found is that the singles ward in New York is really mostly a lot of gay men. So I was still not dating. And in fact, they created a calling in our ward of what actually one of my really good friends. He was on the Compassionate Service Committee, and his whole calling was to talk to all the gay men in the ward and try and keep them on the straight and narrow.
Wow. So he was supposed to keep tabs on their activities?
Not necessarily. He's the type of person, I mean, he's openly gay now. He's gave that up. But he's the type of person that, he's actually a therapist, so he was talking to people and, you know, helping them just process their experiences and what could help them stay in the church.
Okay.
So yeah, so dating did not happen here either.
And you were still kind of in the mindset that you only wanted to date Mormons.
Yes, but I did kind of, after a couple years of this, I realized that that was not working for me, but I didn't know how to do it otherwise. I really didn't know how to navigate a relationship with someone who was not Mormon. So what I did was I just kind of stop trying and just totally poured myself into my career.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where I felt like your story felt, I hope you don't mind if I reference your story.
No, that's totally
fine. But your story really spoke to me.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, you were saying like, I can't marry someone who is a good Mormon person.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm going to just focus on other things. Whereas I felt the same way, but I said, I'm going to just focus on my career.
Mm-hmm.
I did, you know, and I worked, I still do work with kids in foster care.
Mm-hmm.
I do trauma specific therapy with kids who have physical and sexual abuse histories.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just poured all of my heart, might, mind, and strength into these kids that I worked with and mm-hmm. just shut off that part of my life because I just knew it wasn't going to work for me. I knew, you know, living at BYU for all that, you know, all that time and, you know, not really connecting with Mormon men in that
mm-hmm.
way.
Mm-hmm.
And then here, there was really not many options.
Yeah. So were you attending church at that time or did you go inactive? And
I did go to church. And I should also say, remember, I was telling you my sophomore year at college, I had this, mm-hmm. I had this college boyfriend. We reconnected at some point. He was living in California. And so it kind of was easy for me. You know, we were talking and we did see each other and talked about getting back together. And we were like on and off for the next like 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
So I really held on to that relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it was clearly not going anywhere mm-hmm. after like the second year or the third year, you know,
mm-hmm.
but that's something that such a huge regret for me that I felt like this is maybe my only chance to be with a Mormon is this guy. So I really hung on for a lot longer than, you know,
than you wish you had.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm sorry. You asked me a question and I don't know if that was my answer or not.
No.
Oh,
yeah,
was
no,
I going to church? I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, in 2002, I believe,
mm-hmm.
They started the construction on the New York Temple.
Mm-hmm.
And because we had, at that point, we did have 3 singles wards, they combined all of the singles wards together because there was just not enough space for them after they decided to build a temple.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So they combined the 3 wards together, and it was like 500 people going to church every Sunday. And that was when I just said, I'm not going to go to the singles ward anymore. But I wasn't quite ready to go to the family ward.
Uh-huh.
And here in New York, we have so many single people in our wards that we don't even call them family wards. They're called conventional wards here.
Okay.
Because there's just so many.
Mm-hmm.
So I took a couple of weeks off. I just said, I don't want to go to that to church. I'm going to just take a break and see how it feels.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a point where I felt like I wanted to go back, like I missed it.
Mm-hmm.
So I did go back and I started going to this conventional ward / family ward. And right away they put me in Cub Scouts, if you can believe that. And then I was in primary.
The church has no idea what to do with single people, I don't think.
They don't at all. It's totally true. In fact,
or young married people who don't have children. Those seem to be the two groups that the church can't really figure out what to do with.
Exactly. And so, yeah, in fact, our bishop at the time, so there were a couple of us that made the decision once they started doing construction on the temple. There were a couple of us, myself and some other friends, that decided we were going to go to this other ward. And our bishop like freaked out. He said, I don't know what to do with you. And I just felt like saying, like, we're just people.
Right.
You don't have to treat us any differently, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they didn't know what to do with us. And then I think once the temple was finished, they actually dissolved our ward, the the singles word for 27 and older. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And that really bothered me because I just felt, even though it was my choice to leave, it really bothered me that they were just like, you know, there's no hope for you. Mm-hmm. You should just move on. You know, you're done.
Right.
So I did go to church for a couple of years once I transitioned to that ward. And like I said, I was in a couple different callings. And anytime I had a calling that was not a Sunday calling, I was super happy.
Mm-hmm.
Cause then I would just not go on Sundays.
Mm-hmm.
But the last time that I attended all three meetings, I don't remember how long ago this was, but I said, I'm not coming back because it was Sunday school. Sacrament meeting was about families. Sunday school was about marriage and families and Relief Society without marriage and families.
Right.
So there's just this point where I was just like, there's just nothing here for me. This is so painful mm-hmm. to come to church here. So that was when I said, I'm not going back.
I was debating whether or not I should ask you whether or not going to church was painful because I didn't want to make that assumption. But mm-hmm. when I graduated college and moved to Boise, I think I went to church two times and I just could not do it. It's like being it's not like being forced. It is being forced to sit for 3 hours and have shoved in your face what you want, but you don't have.
Absolutely.
And I don't think that the church realizes that that is what it's like to be a single person in a family ward.
One of my friends went to somebody else's, one of her work friends or something, had a baby that was being blessed
mm-hmm.
or whatever they do in that religion. I don't even know what it was.
Christening or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. And she just came home and she said, oh my gosh, it was so nice. All they did was talk about Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, like, the fact that that occurs to you, that it's different mm-hmm. is not good, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like I just started feeling like the only reason they talk about families so much is because they want people to feel like they're doing the right thing. Like they have, you know, they did what they were supposed to. They got married when they were young or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
They had babies.
Mm-hmm.
The mom is staying home to raise the babies. They are doing what they want, you know, what they are supposed to do. And so every Sunday felt like they're just patting themselves on the back for, mm-hmm. for making these choices.
Mm-hmm.
So for someone like me, who, like I said, I did not want to get married at 19.
Mm-hmm.
I chose to go on a mission. I wasn't one of those people who did it because they weren't married and they felt obligation.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not to say I didn't want those things too. Of course I did. And
mm-hmm.
I still do. But yeah, so when you say it's painful, it is hard. In some ways, it's hard for me to talk about too, because I feel like everybody knows that, like, bitter old spinster that sits in the back of church or, like, you know, bears their testimony about how much they want to get married.
Mm-hmm.
And I also don't want to be that person. Like, mm-hmm. I don't want to be someone that people, like, feel sorry for or mm-hmm. feel like, oh, she's so great. Why can't she just find a good guy? You know, mm-hmm. that kind of a thing.
Right.
I struggled with it for 10 years of just feeling like I really don't fit in here. And I was praying and hoping and wishing and, you know, that I was going to have that
mm-hmm.
that happy ending that mm-hmm. I felt like I'd been promised because I'd been faithful.
Right.
I would say it was probably a good 8 to 10 years of me doing that.
Oh, you put up with it a lot longer than I did.
I put it up with a long time, right? I started really doubting that there was a God before I started doubting anything about the church.
And why do you think that happened?
Because I just felt like my prayers were just going nowhere and no one is really there listening. I went from feeling like, you know, God sent me to Norway to meet this one specific person
mm-hmm.
to marry to, there's no God, you know, it's just a totally, totally weird, mm-hmm. weird thing. I mean, looking back, it's just so strange to me that I started doubting God before I doubted the church. When things went really bad with this Norwegian person, I just went, oh my gosh, all of this is in my head. I invented this entire scenario. Mm-hmm. And I could say that about other people too. Other people that were like, no, I know I was meant to be with this person and this is where I'm supposed to be. And I would just say, it's not true. You are making up your own, mm-hmm. this mm-hmm. whole path. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, that's why, you know, I was saying my conversion story in quotes from the beginning. That is one experience that I still sometimes have a hard time going, did I really make all of that up, that experience? Because it was such a powerful emotional thing at the time. But, you can explain it away with emotions, I guess. Mm-hmm.
So how long have you been inactive, for lack of a better term? Have you resigned?
I have not resigned.
So technically you're just inactive.
Yes.
How long have you been not going to church?
Like I said, I really has on and off for the past probably 8 to 10 years, but I have not gone for 2 years. And I felt kind of in the beginning, I thought this is just working for me now. Mm-hmm. And I might go back. And then I kind of went I could, but I probably won't. And now it's like, I will not go back ever. And, you know, that came with finding out, finding out all of these, how all these truth claims are not true. Mm-hmm. And, the stuff that people talk about finding out, that's just so disturbing. Mm-hmm. But really, I had lost my testimony before I found out all of that stuff. So I know people kind of, they feel like they're being hit over the head going, oh my gosh, what have I believed in all these years? For me, it was like, oh my gosh, thank goodness, it's all not true. Because I really don't want to have anything to do with it anyway. Mm-hmm. And now I don't have to feel guilty or feel bad or anything. I can just live my life,
Right, right. So for about 2 years, have you been purposely moving on from the church, like developing a new set of, a new social life, a new focuses in life?
I mean, not necessarily, but I reconnected with some people from my mission, and we're all bitter apostates. And so it's funny, like it's been such a long time, but I feel like I talk to them more than I talk to somebody who lives down the street for me sometimes. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's online. It's not real talking, but. Mm-hmm. And then my younger sister, she's just a year younger than me. She and I kind of always grew up having similar feelings about the church, but I think she, like I said, she didn't even have like the social connection. So she left earlier than I did. Mm-hmm. So we talk a lot about this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. My other good friends, my friend that I grew up with, she's here. She lives in Brooklyn. So we hang out a lot. Not that I didn't see them or talk to them before, but I feel like they were kind of guarded about wanting to share things about their feelings about the church. Mm-hmm. And now we can have a lot more open conversations about it. And I never put that on them. I never, with my gay friends, I never ever blame them for leaving the church. I would say, I totally agree. I would do it. I would leave too. Mm-hmm. And I really honestly did not judge them. Mm-hmm. But I think there was something that they still felt like they had to hold back with me because they did see me as such a, somebody with a strong belief in the church. Mm-hmm. So all of that is gone, which is really nice. Mm-hmm. And I just try not to talk to people who I think are going to think that I've gone crazy. when I talk about things that I just find so offensive about the church and the teachings.
So you told me that you've given up your anger towards the church. What were your feelings towards the church? Anger
well,
about
I
what?
I felt like because the church told me that I can only date certain, specific groups of people, like faithful Mormon men, that was what I should stick with. Mm-hmm. I felt like it really limited my options. Mm-hmm. But then on the flip side, when it didn't happen for me, then I was an outsider. Mm-hmm. So I just would feel really angry towards the church and feeling like I was not, again, just like being rewarded for doing all of the things that I was supposed to do my whole life.
Right.
That's what's ironic is my life has not changed one bit, but my feelings about it have changed because now that I know it's not true, I don't feel all of that pressure or that those feelings of, you know, which I know doesn't make any sense. You know, it doesn't make any sense that you'd think I'd be more angry now, mm-hmm. you know, but I really have felt I've let go of all of that.
So where are you in the faith spectrum now? I'm assuming since you said you believe you gave up a belief in God before Mormonism that you're atheist.
Yes, it's sort of hard for me to still say that, but I would say yes. Mm-hmm. I'm an atheist.
Okay.
Yeah, I think I said it like out loud one time. So, yeah.
Okay. But I was just wondering if you'd move to maybe a general Christianity or.
Oh, no, definitely not. Very early on, I kind of felt like I did have friends that have done that. And I just thought, I have no interest in any of that. And when I started feeling like the Mormon church is not true, I didn't want to have anything to do with other churches. But once I really knew it was not true, then I started thinking, maybe I should be a Catholic. I have no idea why. I think it was because I was listening to someone else who kind of converted to Catholicism as an adult, and mm-hmm. he made it sound really great. But no, I really, really enjoy my Sundays just being doing other things. And, mm-hmm. you know, I work really hard, and it's really nice to have a full weekend to myself and not have to think about getting dressed up and going out anymore. So,
yeah, I would think with the kind of job you have, you need to decompress on the weekends.
Yeah, it can be really, really overwhelming sometimes. And that's actually another thing I didn't mention is being so into these kids' lives, you know, kids that growing up in foster care. That is another thing that really has affected my belief in God. I always heard people say, well, if there was a God, he wouldn't let these horrible things happen. Mm-hmm. And that didn't make sense to me, but I totally get it now. Mm-hmm. Because I really felt like there was a point where I just said, you know, really most people suffer a lot. Mm-hmm. Instead of feeling like it was a minority of people who suffer, there's really a lot of people who suffer. And I know my view of the world is probably still a little bit skewed. I kind of try and look at more positive things, but mm-hmm. that really did affect my feeling of God as well. And so that's why I think it's easy for me to say, if there is a God, then I don't think he cares about mm-hmm. some of these small things that we worry so much about in the Mormon church, you know? Mm-hmm.
I've always been able to accept the idea that God has to stay out of people's choices in order to let them have free agency. But the part where it becomes trite is when he's staying out of people's free agency when there's really horrible suffering going on as a result, but he'll go ahead and meddle in people's lives for small things.
Exactly. When you start thinking about it, it just doesn't make any sense.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It doesn't make any sense at all.
Exactly. Anyway, well, thanks for joining us on Mormon Expression Voices. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Heather. Mm-hmm.
And letting go has not been easy. But I don't need you loving me for who you think I should be. Sure yet of who I will become. Oh, but I'm feeling brave, I guess. I'm feeling beautiful as I make no excuse. And I move to the edge and I take my great leap. It doesn't matter if I fall, 'cause leaps and falls make me a better me.
Directing, producing, and editing was done by Heather C., and the theme music was provided by McCall Erickson. Thank you for listening. Mormon Expression Voices is a production of the Whitefields Educational Foundation. Find us on the web at whitefieldseducational.org. The Mormon Expression and Mormon Expression Voices podcasts, as well as other educational initiatives, are made possible by your generous donations. Please consider a subscription today.